if the White House really wants to roll up its sleeves and get bold about ocean conservation, then we need to see it, and the time to start is right now in the Aleutian Islands.
A call for a marine sanctuary in the Aleutian Islands region. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, development in the Arctic will take longer than some have predicted.
This is the reality. You know, the boom is not there, and whatever will happen will take years and years and years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Governor Bill Walker has delegated his authority on the Point Thompson lawsuit to his lieutenant governor, while still leaving open the possibility of his involvement. In a letter signed on Monday, Walker granted Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott the power to decide if Walker's prior litigation against the state while an attorney in private practice should prevent him from participating in decisions about those same cases in his new role as governor. Walker describes the delegation of authority as a precautionary measure.
I'd rather be ahead of this and have something in place in the event a conflict came along.
Walker says that if Mallott chooses to block his involvement in these cases, he'll respect that. Walker does not anticipate that outcome affecting his working relationship with the lieutenant governor.
It would be his independent call, and I would certainly honor whatever his determination was.
Mallott is currently in Hawaii and was not available for an interview on his newly granted power and how he intends to exercise it. As a partner at the Anchorage law firm Walker & Richards, Walker sued the state over a settlement with Exxon to develop Point Thompson, and the case became a point of contention during the campaign against incumbent Sean Parnell. Parnell argued that Walker's lawsuit would halt development of natural gas reserves on the North Slope, while Walker responded that the agreement amounted to a closed-door deal by bypassing the legislature. The letter comes just days after his former law partner and current Attorney General Craig Richards relinquished his own authority to participate in such litigation in more specific terms. On Friday, Richards wrote that his Chief Assistant Attorney General Martin Schultz would take on those cases until his former clients no longer have financial obligations to him. In addition to the Point Thompson case, Richards wrote he would recuse himself from a number of municipal property tax proceedings concerning the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Walker and Richards sold their law firm shortly after the election to attorney Robin Brenna, who chaired the Walker Transition Team's Oil and Gas Committee. Walker says he has not been in touch with Brenna on the status of any of his former cases since the firm's sale, and that he has no remaining financial obligations from his former clients. The waters around the Aleutian Islands support a dizzying range of wildlife and major industries right along with it. But now the government's job is to help find a balance. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, there's a new campaign to permanently tip the scales toward conservation in the Aleutian chain.
Since Congress first started making national marine sanctuaries back in the 1970s, only a handful of sites have gotten protection. A lot of them are in the South Pacific and along the Gulf Coast. And according to Rick Steiner, they were pretty quiet to begin with.
There's no one living there. There's not a lot of shipping in the area. There's virtually no commercial fishing. And so the threats in that area are nowhere near what they are in the Aleutians and southeastern Bering Sea.
That's the zone that Steiner and other marine conservationists want to turn into a federal sanctuary. They've nominated a swath that stretches all the way to Nunavak Island near Bethel. It's almost twice as big as the country's largest reserve, even after President Barack Obama expanded it this year. Steiner says the exact size is negotiable. What matters is that the administration seems to be looking for a way to leave a mark.
If the White House really wants to roll up its sleeves and get bold about ocean conservation, which it pretends it wants to, then we need to see it, and the place to start and the time to start is right now in the Aleutian Islands.
If it's accepted, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration could make new rules to protect the Aleutian ecosystem, and that could lead to tougher limits on fishing and other big industries. Steiner says cargo ships should be sent further offshore to prevent the risk of accidents and spills, and he also wants NOAA to put the brakes on oil and gas leasing along the entire Aleutian chain, including the Bristol Bay area. The president recently banned lease sales there, but Steiner says that wasn't airtight.
Congress could easily undo that by putting a bitter pill in a must-sign bill, or a future administration could undo it. So we want that put to bed permanently.
The same goes for a long-running conservation battle in the Western Aleutians over an endangered group of Steller sea lions. Federal biologists, fishing companies, and environmentalists have spent more than 15 years fighting over the best way to protect sea lions. For a while, that meant shutting down commercial fishing. But new studies showed that it probably wouldn't hurt to relax some of those restrictions, and the change went into effect the day after Christmas. Michael Levine has been working on the case for Oceana.
Rather than implementing protections and removing them and fighting about their sufficiency, we need a long-term plan for this region and a commitment to maintaining the health and biodiversity of this ocean ecosystem over the long term.
While Levine works on yet another lawsuit, the sanctuary advocates want the government to try a different approach. They're asking NOAA to bring back the old restrictions on commercial fishing for good, and they want a new ban on bottom trawling past a certain point in the Aleutian chain. That's a sticking point for Stephanie Madsen, who represents vessels in the ATSI Processors Association. She says they're well-suited to rough waters, but Madsen has deeper concerns about making the Aleutians into a sanctuary. As a former member of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, she wants to know,
you know, who actually gets to design fishing restrictions in a marine sanctuary, where the jurisdictional boundaries go, and kind of who's on first?
The answer to that question could be a long way off. NOAA has to conduct a preliminary review to figure out whether the Aleutians are eligible to become a sanctuary, something that wouldn't happen without extensive studies and plenty of time for public hearings and public comment. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
2014 has proved to be a slow year for Arctic shipping. Just 31 ships sailed between Europe and Asia across the Northern Sea Route, and 22 did part of the route. That's down from a total of more than 70 in 2013. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports the shipping stats indicate the predicted Arctic boom may be slower to arrive and less dramatic than many had predicted.
Malta Humpert is the executive director of the Arctic Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. He says this year has served as a reality check on some of the overheated Arctic predictions of recent years.
So I think 2014 kind of shows that developments in Arctic shipping may be further off than we might have thought a few years ago, that the ice is not melting as quickly as previously predicted.
Humpert says shipping is a good indicator of economic activity on the ground in the Arctic. 2007 and 2012 were low ice years, fueling excitement about Arctic resource extraction, container shipping, even large-scale tourism. Then, this year, the ice rebounded a bit. Not only did the number of ships drop off, but Humpert says the purpose changed too.
Last year, we had a lot of oil carriers. We had one LNG carrier. We had iron ore. We had timber, so a lot of natural resources. And this year, we have actually a few passenger ships. We had some heavy lift vessels, so that indicates that there was building equipment, like an oil platform being transported or other kind of heavy industrial equipment being brought into the Arctic, into the Russian Arctic.
Humpert closely watches the Northern Sea Route. That's the course over the top of Russia, meaning if you're coming from Asia, you go through the Bering Strait and hang a left. It's not just ice that's put a damper on Arctic activity. Humpert says Russia is feeling the effects of sanctions resulting from its move on Ukraine. That has scaled back Russian oil activity, and low oil prices haven't helped. Humpert says he hears a new tone among Arctic forecasters these days.
I think in general, the pendulum of excitement and reality, it might be swinging back towards the reality a little bit.
Joël Plouffe, a Montreal-based managing editor of the journal Arctic Yearbook, has noticed the same thing. Plouffe says the opening of the Arctic has been oversold as a major and immediate boom, but it remains a region where access is limited and development expensive.
This is the reality. You know, the boom is not there, and whatever will happen will take years and years and years.
Still, he does see some exciting developments this year, starting with the Northwest Passage. That's the course you'd be on if you went north through the Bering Strait and turned right over Alaska and Canada. The Northwest Passage sees much less traffic than the Northern Sea Route, but this year, Plouffe says, one transit was a commercial ship traveling without a separate icebreaker.
The shipping company called FedNav was the first shipping company to actually take some minerals out of the Canadian Arctic and ship them out to China using the Northwest Passage. And using drones to help them navigate in Arctic waters. So that's something new, and this pattern will continue.
Andy says this year saw the first shipments of oil from Russia's Arctic waters. Plouffe says expectations of a sudden boom may have helped focus some American attention on the Arctic, at least in Congress and among some journalists. Now Plouffe hopes that focus can be expanded to concern for people, the high energy bills in rural Alaska, for instance, and the safety of travel in the region.
It might not be as sexy as talking about the big boom, but there's a lot of work to be done to explain to people that eventually what will happen in the north when there'll be less ice, there will be more human activity. So this is not a boom. This is just more human beings traveling in the north and being more vulnerable also.
Both Plouffe and Humpert say climate change is transforming the Arctic, even if the pace of its impact on shipping has been overhyped at times. Humpert likened it to the gold rush, which forever changed California, although many reports at the time of easy riches proved to be exaggerations. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the acting commissioner of Fish and Game lays out his priorities.
Anybody you talk to, they say, you know, fish first. So, number one, protect the resource.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Oil prices continue to fall, with Brent crude around $55 a barrel this morning, and gasoline prices are dipping below $3 per gallon in Anchorage. But even as fuel prices plummet, rural Alaskans are unlikely to see major savings. Sean Thomas is the vice president of Energy and Shipping Corporation Crowley Maritime. He says Western Alaska's unique geography is a contributing factor to static fuel prices in the region.
The Western Alaska market is not a traditional market that you would see, you know, at the corner gas station. Those markets are served by very large bulk orders that are placed into tank farms, and then they are pretty much locked in by ice, I mean, quite physically. So new product does not get into those locations until the ice goes out.
Thomas says the price customers see at a gas station in Nome, for example, reflects the market value of gasoline during the summer when Crowley purchased the fuel. Gasoline stored in tank farms throughout the winter has already been paid for and doesn't fluctuate with world market prices. Nome utility manager John Handelman says most utility systems in the region operate under a similar purchasing system. He says the Western Alaska Fuel Group, a consortium of communities including Nome, Unalakleet, Kotzebue, and Dillingham, purchase diesel and other fuels in bulk, trying to minimize costs during the limited summer window. The group receives its fuel from Vitus Marine, Handelman says, at an average price calculated for the month when the order was placed. And though the current market fluctuations are extreme, he notes that the price of oil tends to rise in summer and fall in winter every year. Thomas says summers do generally mean a spike in fuel prices, a trend he attributes partially to demand. But while locked-in prices may seem burdensome while the market is low, he says stable fuel prices have also benefited rural customers in the past.
If you think back just a couple years ago when oil was trading at $60, $70, $80 a barrel and spiked to $140 a barrel, and people in Anchorage and elsewhere were paying, you know, twice as much at the gas stations, places like Nome and Bethel and Kotzebue, prices stayed the same.
As for whether current market lows will hold until next summer's purchasing season, both Handelland and Thomas agree only time will tell. Fish and game resources are important to nearly every Alaskan, and the state's new acting commissioner of Fish and Game says he'll take that to heart as he makes decisions. Sam Cotton is a former Democratic state lawmaker. More recently, he's been a commercial fisherman and a member of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Cotton says he grew up sport fishing in Palmer.
People ask me whether I'm a commercial fisherman or a sport fisherman, and I think it's important that to point out that a lot of people in Alaska do both, and I have a strong appreciation for both. And I'm not a subsistence user, but I've done some personal use fishing and done some hunting and trapping as well. But that's one of my initial goals, is to try to bridge a few gaps between the what sometimes are the headline issues of competition amongst user groups. So I'm one of those people that do both and appreciate both.
What are the biggest issues you'll be focused on in this department in the years ahead?
The one thing that no matter who you talk to about game issues or fish issues, most people want decisions about fish and game in Alaska to be based on sound science. The politics that get involved are usually over allocations. And that's always going to be the case. We have a board of game, and we have a board of fisheries that makes allocation decisions. And but from the department's perspective, we need to make sure that we are doing the right research so that we can make good scientific decisions. We have an outstanding professional staff, amazing scientific minds that are outstanding employees at the department that have a lot of talent, and so part of our effort is to ensure that we employ good science and we do the right research, do the right surveys, so that the decision makers at the boards can make good decisions. So that's always number one. Anybody you talk to, they say, fish first. So number one, protect the resource, ensure that we have proper escapements, ensure that all of our resource game and fish are managed to where we sustain populations. That's always number one. We have a lot of other challenges, and they vary, but I'll start with that one.
Over the past couple of years, former Governor Sean Parnell has committed state funding to Chinook research with the purpose of examining the reason for the stock's decline. In the capital budget that was released on Monday, that money was zeroed out. How do you plan to address the declining king runs in a time when there may be fewer resources available to ADF&G?
That's a good question. The initial program envisioned $30 million that would be put into Chinook salmon research. About half of that has already been appropriated, so there's some work going on. I understand the importance of it. And I suspect that there'll be legislators who will not only understand the importance of it, but assign a pretty high priority to it. So that's important research, but we'll have to see on the money.
The state is looking at a very different budget situation than in recent years, and Governor Walker has asked every department to look at cutting budgets. Have you identified areas in Fish and Game for potential cuts?
I'm not going to identify any of those right now, but we've been going through an exercise to address that looming probability that we are going to have to tighten our belts. And so we've got some different scenarios based on how much the cuts are, and so some general approaches. I'm meeting with the governor's Office of Budget Management for our first round of talks. So we're prepared to show them where we'd have to go. We're prepared to participate in the belt tightening that everybody's going to have to face.
As part of the transition, Governor Walker put together a team to look at the issue of subsistence. The subject has always been intensely emotional and divisive. Do you think we'll see any action on this issue from your department next year? Are there any plans to reopen the question of subsistence priority in the new year?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know that the governor hasn't announced any legislative initiatives on that subject. I suppose it's possible. There are some as a result of the transition team exercises, which I didn't attend. I was unable to do that. But there are some groups that, from what I'm told, traditionally might find themselves on opposite sides of fences that are talking about improvements to the management system, maybe unifying some of the management systems that are there now. I think those are conceptual thoughts that are finding some good agreement, but I'm not able to say that they've been put into bill form or specific initiatives yet. But I know there's a new look by people that may not have seen things the same way in the past.
House Bill 77, that it was designed to streamline the process for issuing land use and water permits. It was hugely controversial last session. The bill came from the Parnell administration. What do you plan to do with it?
We are, I don't plan to do anything with it. I mean, I understood the initial goal was to streamline, but I think it's pretty clear that that was not a well-received approach by most people to reduce public input, reduce restrictions on water rights, to make it more difficult for people to have a say in things like that. So that's not going to be something that we're going to pursue.
Sam Cotton is the acting commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
As of midnight tonight, the city of Anchorage can claim a new record. The city did not see a temperature drop below zero for the entire year of 2014. The last time Anchorage residents saw a below zero reading was December 26th of 2013. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Meteorologist Rebecca Duell with the National Weather Service says this is the second longest stretch like this since record keeping began in 1916. She says the last time Anchorage temperatures stayed at zero or above for so long was in 2000 to 2001, when it didn't go below zero for 683 days. But she says there have been plenty of years when only a day or two barely dipped below zero, so she sees this year as not that unusual.
In the grand scheme of things, no, this is pretty normal to get fluctuations like this with temperatures in terms of any long-term patterns. This is a warmer year. You know, if we were to start seeing it for multiple years consecutively, then we would, you know, it might mean something, but at this point, this is fairly normal.
Duell says the movement of storms is the reason for the warmer temperatures.
The storm track has really been taking the storms a specific direction that's giving us a lot of southerly flow. So the air is bringing up a lot of warmer air, which is why we're getting these warmer temperatures. And another reason is that We kind of have this persistent low-pressure system in the Gulf of Alaska. It's been causing a lot of cloudy weather, especially in southern Alaska.
Jewel says it's when we have clear conditions that we lose the most heat. She says the forecast is calling for clear skies later this week.
We're going to have high pressure, and so we'll have some clearer days, and we're really going to dip down and get pretty cold later in the week.
The forecast calls for Anchorage area temperatures to drop to 5 to 15 degrees on Friday and Saturday. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
This time of year, many of us have been buying pasta or cans of soup to contribute to food drives. But food banks say they could use foods with protein. From Seattle, KPLU business and labor reporter Ashley Gross has this story of a Bainbridge Island nonprofit that's delivering that in a unique way.
Volunteers are dishing up lunch to about 200 people in need at the Millionaire Club charity in downtown Seattle.
Thank you. Okay, let's do equal sizes here.
But the menu might surprise you.
Today we're serving baked salmon. We're doing brown rice with soy sauce with it.
Brett Herman is director of programs at the Millionaire Club. He says they usually serve fish once a week.
Are the fish days more popular than other days?
It's probably the number one requested lunch we get.
Millionaire Club gets its fish donated from a Bainbridge nonprofit called SeaShare. Jim Harmon is SeaShare's executive director. He says fishermen in the Bering Sea started it 20 years ago. They had an idea of how to make use of fish caught by accident.
When you're fishing for pollock and you get a high-value salmon in your net, the rule was you had to throw that salmon overboard. So there's no incentive to retain it for commercial gain. SeaShare came up with an idea to retain those fish only for hunger relief.
They got the okay, and now more than 200 million seafood servings have been donated. Harmon says sometimes people need ideas for how to cook fish, so SeaShare goes to food banks to share recipes.
We do a lot of canned salmon, so we go and show them how to make salmon tacos, you know, or salmon patties. You can use it as a replacement for hamburger or ground turkey.
Getting fish from the ocean to a food bank in Boston, say, or Los Angeles, is a feat of coordination and goodwill by many companies along the way. But not everything is donated. SeaShare pays for some freezer space and processing. So this month, the nonprofit is trying to raise enough money to give an additional 1 million seafood servings. I'm Ashley Gross in Seattle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Francesca Frenzy in Nome, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Ashley Gross in Seattle. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Happy New Year.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.